Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I'm your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. First, I want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I also want to tell you about what's coming up in July. Our team at Responsive want to invite you to participate in 6 hours of online CFRE-approved training. I am talking about a soup-to-nuts fundraising philosophy that will ensure your organization is ready for the road ahead. No one on the planet is going to offer you tools as researched, as tested, and as sustainable as our 4 frameworks. If you'd like more information about partnering with OneCause, or more information about our upcoming webinar series, look for information in the show notes. After you do, shoot me an email and let me know that you did. Now let's introduce today's guest. Hi, Jess. Thank you for being my guest today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I am delighted to be having this conversation. It's a early Friday morning for me, and it's a midday, perhaps it's a midday Friday afternoon for you. Before we get this conversation started, Jess, would you mind just introducing yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, of course. Hi, Jason. Thanks so much for having me on. So my name's Jess. I am a senior lecturer in documentary image making and ethics at London College of Communications, which is part of the University of the Arts in London. And while I'm not doing that, I'm also a consultant to the NGO sector, helping organizations like the Red Cross and the International Rescue Committee and the Lumos Foundation and various others tell their stories powerfully and ethically. Until about a year and a half ago, I was the global content director for Save the Children, and I have around 15 years experience in the charity sector.
Yeah, Jess, so I have to ask you, I had not talked to anyone who's worked for a large NGO since this COVID-19 thing has sort of taken over the world, I guess you could say. But I know Save the Children has to be extremely affected by all this. What's your read on that? Or are you still in the loop enough to know what's going on there?
Well, I haven't worked at Save the Children for nearly 18 months now, so I can't talk to them in any great detail. But I do know from talking to other organizations that I'm working with at the moment that everyone is a little nervous, I think, about how this is going to impact them on a number of levels. And the conversations I've been having, which tend to center around storytelling and content collection, have really been around how can organizations pivot their work so that they are looking at collecting content more locally, looking at how they get around these problems without putting people on planes, but also without putting people into communities who might spread or the virus further. So there's actually quite a lot of exciting opportunity around that, around user-generated content and around working with local talent, which are the kind of things I spend a lot of time advocating for anyway. But I think there's a bit of nervousness, it's safe to say, and everyone's living with a lot of uncertainty right now, aren't they? We all are.
Yes. I didn't think about that, but that tees up our conversation really well, that because of the reality that we're sitting in, and because we can't, like, I'm a major gifts guy, so I can't hop on a plane and go, you know, solicit a donor directly across a lunch table and try to convey messages very explicitly across, you know, with a cup of coffee between us. You rely on different mediums, and that's what we're here to talk about today. So Jess,
the research that you've done, the work that you've done, I had read your paper that Rogari published. I don't know. I read it about a month ago and reached out to you and said, I think this would be a fascinating conversation to have on the podcast. Can you kind of tee it up? Because I'm totally with you on the idea that beneficiaries probably need to be better represented in the way that we appeal to our donors. The voice of that, the voice of who it is we're raising support for, certainly in my mind, I've been a part of this debate for a number of times over the years. I think it's a fascinating and oftentimes an overlooked conversation. But you want to tee it up, the sort of the questions that you're asking, and we'll just follow your lead.
Okay, thanks. My research focus area is around, like you say, around including the voices of what I call contributors, or what are more commonly known as beneficiaries, in this debate about representation and how the people who feature in the communications that we make as a sector, how they should be featured in those communications. And what we've seen up till now, and really since the kind of Ethiopian famine in the 1980s, is a lot of academic and media debate and discussion, and some really important texts looking at the way that those people are represented and the impact of that representation in terms of long-term stereotypes, the risk of stereotype threat, the long-term impact on how certain communities and parts of the world are viewed in negative, you know, and how that can create long-term negative impacts. So there's a real wealth of really good and important debate around how we see those images and how we respond as audiences to those images. But what I realized about halfway through my time at Save the Children, so in the kind of around the 2012-2015 mark, was that there was very little heard from the people who I was spending. So I was traveling all over the world to Save the Children, gathering stories in lots of different scenarios. And the people I was meeting had really strong stories to tell, and were very opinionated about how their stories should be told. But that wasn't coming across. And so I ended up being part of, you know, lots of media interviews where the media were being quite critical of charity communications. And I felt that rather than standing here and defending it from yet another Westerner talking about how, you know, people in predominantly developing world countries should be represented, it would actually be more useful for me to just go and speak to those people and ask them what they thought about, A, their portrayal in the communications that we make as a sector, but also, really importantly, in the process of sharing their stories and what they felt, how they found that process. And that's kind of what kicked off. So the report that I wrote for Rogari was published this year, but back in 2015, I published, 2017, I published a report called The People in the Pictures, which I co-wrote with someone called Siobhan Warrington. And in that, we went and interviewed just over 200 people who featured in Save the Children's content in the UK, Niger, Bangladesh, and Syrian refugees in living in Jordan at the time. And we asked them a whole series of questions, and we showed them a lot of the content that Save the Children had created, some of which they featured in themselves and some of which was more general content. And we asked them lots of questions, predominantly around their motivation for sharing their story, how they found the process of sharing their story, and what they thought about their later portrayal. And that research, it turned out, was the first time anyone had ever done that, which I have to admit, when we first went into it, I was just kind of curious and felt like it was important for me as a creator of content for that was being used all over the world to really get a better grasp of what those people had to say.
So when you're doing that, if you're asking the, so how do you go do that type of work for an organization like Save the Children? So are you actually sitting down with the children themselves and allowing them to look at the, say, the images or the story that's being told? Or are you meeting with their parents? I mean, what does that look like for me to say if I was in your seat and I'm traveling to another part of the world, to an impoverished, you know, marginalized community somewhere in the world, and ask it somewhere that obviously Save the Children serves? And how do I do that? That's fascinating.
So, I mean, the ethics of actually how you gather that content, and especially Save the Children employee, are obviously you know, tricky to navigate socially. Yeah. I spent a lot of time thinking about how we were going to make that work. personally, I was the only Save the Children employee that was involved in gathering the interviews. And I was involved in a very hands-off way. So first of all of the interviews that we conducted were conducted by people who weren't direct employees of Save the Children, just to try.
Okay.
ourselves a bit. So Siobhan was a contractor. She conducted some of them. We also had other researchers working with us on that. And we did it in a whole variety of ways, depending on the age of the participant and the situation that they were in at that time. So for young children, we held kind of game playing workshops where we would give them a series of photos and they would pick which was their favorite, and they would talk about why they liked that photo and how it made them feel. And we would literally have them kind of like running down rows of photos and stopping on one they liked. And it was very physical. Whereas for teenagers, it would be more discursive more kind of traditional interview style, as well as holding focus groups and workshops. We translated all of the materials into the local languages of everyone we were going to meet. So when they saw a film, there was a voiceover from their local language, for example, so everyone could really engage with everything we showed them. And typically we were told, it was interviews, focus groups and workshops. And the first part of that would be showing them a series of pieces of content, usually several films, several printed materials, some online content, all translated for them, like I said. And then we would have a series of questions that we asked each participant to try and kind of gather information. We allow people to bring any partners or friends or family members that they wanted to bring with them to make it feel more comfortable with them. They chose where the interviews happened, again, to make it feel more comfortable. So we thought really hard about that. I mean, I think it's safe to say, and we acknowledge this in the report, that because it was Save the Children investigating Save the Children's representation, there's always going to be a degree where you can argue that it wasn't as objective as it could have been. But I feel like I certainly didn't go into it hoping that we would find only good things, and the organization went into it with an open mind. Look, and I really must commend Save the Children for doing this, because it was a brave thing to do, to go and ask those questions, and a braver thing to do, to agree to that being published externally. And there was quite a lot of media interest in it when it first was published, and not everything we found out was good. That has to be said.
So if you and I, so if I'm your researcher, you're sitting in the room with us and we've got a little boy, we'll say he's 10 years old and he lives in a, third world country, and you're showing him images. Is he looking at images of himself or images of, say, another 10-year-old? And is it safe to assume that he's generally pointing to the photograph that most favorably represents him, that he, or is he, because the photograph, for the sake of my listeners, I want to make sure that they understand sort of the tension in this. It's the difference between what the beneficiary, the child who will benefit from the funding, being represented in that photograph versus the photograph that most compels the donor to give the gift. Am I right? That's essentially the tension that we're talking about.
Well, so that's the broader context of this tension. We're not trying to ask contributors to do was to answer that question or to provide a solution to that tension, because that would be putting too much responsibility on their shoulders and a bit unfair, I kind of think. So what instead we were doing was a similar process that we would go through with a donor focus group, where we might show a donor a finished DRTV ad and kind of monitor their response in a number of ways. It was sort of similar with this. So we would show, sometimes a child would be watching a piece of content that they were in, but they would always be watching a number of other pieces of content from other places around the world, as well as content from where they were as well, that they were not in. And so it was less to do with trying to solve that tension, although obviously we hope we're going to get some content out which is going to look at that, and more to do with, it was more about adding voices into the debate that are going to create greater nuance and demonstrate that the people we tell stories about have strong opinions about how their stories should be told. So there is an assumption made, and it's an assumption born out of, well-meaning intent, that if you are someone who suffers, that if you are someone who lives in extreme poverty, that you sort of can't understand why someone would come and gather your story and what that story might do. And I knew, and so, and that comes out again and again in the debate around, oh, there's no such thing as informed consent, because no one could ever really be informed, because how could those people possibly understand what we're doing? And it's a ultimately, I think it's a kind of patriarchal assumption and one that removes agency from the people that we're trying to help. And like I said, it's nearly always in a well-meaning way, but it ultimately, you know, does something negative. So what I was trying to demonstrate was that, because I had spent years spending lots of time with people all over the world living in those kind of situations, was that they A, understood very well why we came and gathered their stories, and B, they had strong opinions about what stories should be told. And what we found really backed that up. So, you know, we found that, I suppose if you're going to sum up the research in, you know, and it's a very chunky, like 200 page report, but in sort of two findings, the first one would be that, that people had strong opinions about what stories should be told, but they really wanted to tell those stories in their own words as well. They didn't want them told about themselves. And this comes through beautifully in a proverb that literally every single person we interviewed in Niger said, which means a song is sweeter in its owner's mouth. And everyone just said that to us over and over again. They wanted to tell their stories themselves in their own voices. The second thing was that literally nobody minded the representations created by NGOs, even some of the most controversial. So the kind of classic direct response television, baby lying on a bed, you know, with malnutrition image, which is, you know, very, very controversial. No one looked at that and said, I hate that image, I wish you hadn't made it. It made them sad. But we heard things like, well, yeah, that's what it was like. And someone very sophisticated. Okay. Syrian teenager told us, yeah, happiness doesn't move people, but, and this is really important, really, really important, they didn't want that to be the only story told about them. So they didn't want that to be their single story. And that was what they all kind of railed against. They were saying, this is true, this happened to us, we are in a position where we're suffering, but there's so many other things about our lives too. And And obviously that's the tension that you're talking to. And knowing that they want to do that doesn't resolve that tension, but it means that we can start thinking, right, well, how do we partner with the people whose stories we're gathering and talk to them in a more meaningful way about what stories they want to tell and how they tell them? Because maybe we can learn something new as well. And so that was a lot of what I did following that in my work at Save the Children.
You know, it reminds me of... So I'm on sort of the other end of the fundraising spectrum. I spent most of my career doing major gift work. So it's the one-on-one, you know, it's across the lunch table sort of direct solicitation with one individual donor. And oftentimes you're trying to align that donor with one beneficiary's story or narrative. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes in major gift work, when you're doing the type of fundraising that I have historically done, you do go straight to those sources, right? And sometimes you're even trying to connect the beneficiary with the benefactor. I mean, I remember in some of my work, especially in higher education, for example, you'll actually have the two individuals in the room, and they'll be talking to each other, and so they're literally exchanging the story, if you will. And so it occurs to me that whereas in some of the more high context, high touch sort of fundraising that we do, that perhaps we have not considered the validity or the necessity of essentially doing the same, the usefulness. I mean, were they more, okay, so as you're gathering these stories, if you're asking, again, going back to this, let's say 10-year-old little boy. So if you're asking him, if he believes he should have a role, that's sort of inadvertently what you're asking him, I guess. Is he giving you a more compelling story than you could have come up with on your own, I guess?
So I'm going to answer that. Yes, essentially. So to answer that, there's a story which probably requires your listeners to go and do a bit of Googling. But so
okay.
we made a project. So one of the things we did following the research was think, right, well, how do we do exactly what you've just asked? And actually, we were looking at everyone from kind of individual giving through to major donors and corporate.
Okay, yeah.
Obviously, yes, Save the Children is a really big organization, is touching all of those kind of donor spaces. And so one of the projects that we carried out was in partnership with an artist called Patrick Willock. And what Patrick does is that he builds stage sets And then people sort of stand and act out their lives in the stage sets. And then he takes a photograph of them standing in their stage set. And the photograph is the product that he creates. So he's an artist. As a massive photography geek myself, I was a fan of his work. And so we approached him and asked if he would come and do a project where we would take him into Syrian refugee camps in Lebanon and Burundian refugee camps in Tanzania and spend a month in each camp working with children in those camps, asking them, A, what stories they wanted to tell, and B, how they wanted to tell them. And what we found was that we got everything from highly political messages from children saying, what are our rights? And, why can't we get an education, through to children who just wanted to tell the story of themselves carrying their baby sibling over a mountaintop in the freezing cold at night, terrified, through to children who literally wanted to build their stage set into a princess castle and just escape from their refugee life by being a princess in a castle for a day while the photograph was taken.
Right.
And everything else you can imagine. And so what came out of that was this series of photos, which were completely led by these kids. They chose the stories. We worked with local carpenters and seamstresses in the camp. They directed them all. They built the whole thing. We just facilitated it. We got these series of photos, and I'll admit it was a completely different way of working. The product, the end result, looked totally different from what the kind of thing we would make usually at Save the Children. But it was phenomenally successful because the photos were so real and so authentic and so unvarnished and so kind of and gave you this window into these children's experience in such a true way. And it ended up being used by our major donors team, loved it. One of our corporate sponsors ended up backfunding the whole project and publishing a book which they distributed to schools. It became the first thing that was sent to an individual donor when they first signed up to to small gift donors and so on and so forth. It just became phenomenally successful. And it was a really special project, but we did other ones like that. But I suppose what it demonstrates is that, yes, it takes more time to work in that way, certainly, and more creativity. But actually, when you do it, you get a product which is so exciting that it really helps stand out. And I should say, from a media perspective, we ended up on the front page of The Guardian and Le Monde and Time Online in this kind of 1 week, which was a great day at the office. But, it does work, and these children do have really interesting stories to tell, interesting ways to tell those stories if we are prepared to spend time, working with them in that way.
So is the person who, so let's say you and I we're sitting down for a cup of coffee with a third person, someone else, and you and I are on the side of the argument that this work should be done, that this should be a very valid, necessary, essential part of the work that we do in raising funds. We should be having these conversations with those who benefit from the fundraising. But are there those who are opposed to sort of facilitating these types of conversations? And is it for more of the, and if there are, is it more for the very pragmatic sort of it's unnecessary, they won't create additional value for the process, let's just get compelling images and stories out there that raise money? Or is it that in some way or another what you all were doing was even part of the exploiting process or something? Would somebody have suggested that what you were actually doing was even inappropriate by doing it? What's the debate? Maybe where's the tension? Yeah.
So I would never advocate for setting up a phone call between a potential donor and a 10-year-old child who's potentially
sure
a former.
Sure.
But I think no one has ever suggested that that there's kind of an inappropriateness, but I think in that way of working you have to be. One of the things that you have to be really careful with is about managing the expectations of the people you're working with. And so you have to be really careful when you go into that situation that because you spend a month in that camp, that you make it really clear to everyone in that camp and the families of the children and, even if you're not working with children who you're working with, that you're not going to pay them for that work. And, they will still receive the aid they receive from the organization you work for, but they're not going to get anything additional because they take part in this. And so it's about, and I mean, one of the things that I do in my consultancy work is work with organizations to set clearer parameters and boundaries around closer working with contributors for that exact reason. And obviously there are bad examples of when that doesn't happen, when that doesn't happen really well. But no, I think that that idea of closer working, it's the principle really is about going into it with a sense that you are a partner in this process, as opposed, you know, with the contributor, as opposed to someone who is extracting a story. And I think, you know, and obviously there's not very many people in this sector. You know, most people come to work in the sector, they certainly don't do it because they think they're going to get paid a lot of money. You know, they come to work in the sector because they want to do something good for the world. So you know, I haven't met a lot anyone who kind of thinks, great, I'll just go and extract a story from this person. But sometimes that is what ends up happening. And so what I guess I'm advocating for is a kind of partnership way of working. Sometimes that's in a very explicit way, like this example I've given you, you know, these photographs that we made in partnership with Patrick Willock. And sometimes that's in a much less explicit way, and it's done through a much more extended consent gathering process, for example. But it's about the principle of partnership primarily. Yeah.
So, okay. So one of the things I thought about when I was and I appreciate knowing that you're in doing consulting work now, because I think this is going to be helpful. So a couple of the questions I wanted to ask. So the first time, Jess, that this sort of tension or debate or concern got on my radar, I was at a conference, 10, 12, maybe 15 years ago. And here in the United States, and you certainly have these in United Kingdom as well, but it was a conversation about the imagery that was used within the rescue mission community. So the rescue missions are the, you know, the homeless shelters is what we would generally understand them to be. And the presenter was talking about how here in the United, this was obviously within the context of fundraising here in the United States. Mm-hmm. The presenter was making the distinction between an image that is generally used in the rescue mission space that represents an older homeless gentleman, you know, full beard, you know, sort of represents in this the homeless gentleman you would see on the side of the street or something, right?
Yeah.
Versus an image that represented a homeless family that displayed a woman, you know, a mother and say three children. Mm-hmm. And what they had figured out is that what the gentleman was saying in the presentation was that in the rescue mission world, one of the things that was happening in that movement was that the narrative or the people that they were serving was starting to become more and more representative of the woman and the three children. But the image of the older gentleman still raised more money. Mm. And so it was the idea that this image that sort of had been ingrained in our mind, you know, that this is the person you're giving money to, was still the more powerful image, even though who it is you're serving doesn't represent. I mean, obviously there's still homeless men in these shelters, but the movement was actually shifting in some ways. And in fact, all of the rescue missions I'm familiar with, for example, have in the last, say, decade, a lot of them have started creating shelters for women and children. Yeah. So it's very consistent with everything. But what's your thoughts on that? I mean, I don't even remember the conclusions that the gentleman came to. But every time I see an appeal from a rescue mission, it always hits my radar because it still tends to be that older gentleman, homeless gentleman, mm-hmm. who's on the side of the street.
Yeah. So I guess that's the stereotype risk, isn't it? I mean, and I've experienced that in the sector as well around things like the migrant crisis, where, you know, we had people coming across from North Africa and from into Europe across the Libya, Italy route, or across the Turkey Greece route. And the stories that we were typically seeing were mostly Syrian people, but actually having spent some time on a boat, fishing people out of the sea, I know that what was mostly coming across, especially on the Libya-Italy route, were young male African men, and just as desperate and often just as young, but not having stories told about them for presumably the reason that there was not as much sympathy for their plight as there was for the famous Syrian plight. One of the things that I try and help organizations do now is think about how they select stories and how they and then how they select the images that they use to tell those stories after they've gathered the stories. And I tend to do this in a one of the quite simple ways I do this is that I set organization sets of questions that they can ask themselves before they go and gather a story and before they and when they're editing and selecting photos. And one of those questions is this an exception to the situation, or is this common and typical of this situation? And it's just trying to encourage organizations to be a bit braver, I guess, in terms of the stories they tell. And tell fuller stories which are more representative of a situation rather than stories which they may feel are more reliable. And I know I've sat in focus groups with donors saying things like, I wouldn't give money to a child that doesn't seem starving. I mean, they're probably fine.
Right.
Things that you hear and when you're working in communications and fundraising and you think, oh, wow. And cautious, obviously, for that reason. But I suppose what Save the Children were amazing at doing when I worked for them was taking risks with the types of content that they shared, and then learning from, and when I say taking risks, I mean telling stories that were not typical in ways that were not typical, but then doing a lot of data gathering and looking at how that worked. And so what I try and encourage organizations to do is say, all right, I get it, you have this big fundraising target and you're nervous that you won't meet it. Why don't you take 5% of your communications budget spend and say, we're going to do two pieces of content which are slightly different from what we've done before, and then we're going to take the data and we're going to be really systematic about it, and we're going to go away, we're going to learn from that data, and we're going to feed it back into what we do all the time. Because and the reason I encourage them to do that is not just because I think ethically it's the right thing to do, because I'm not just in the business of trying to make things ethical, I also want organizations to be able to function, but the reason is because I see this. I talk to a lot of my clients about this kind of triangle of communications, and on each corner you have the contributor or beneficiary, on one corner you have the NGO itself, and on another corner you have the donor. And what we are used to doing in the sector is having a really nice line of communication between the donor and the NGO, and a sort of slightly smaller line of communication between the contributor and the NGO. But what we're not used to doing is having a line of communication between the contributor and the donor. And I don't literally mean people being able to pick up the phone, but I mean making the donor, helping the donor's relationship to be with a contributor as much as it is with the NGO. And I think in the major donor space that you're talking about, that actually happens a lot more often. But in the kind of broader individual giving space, that doesn't happen as much as it could do. The stories are quite generic, and it's much more about what the NGO is doing. And so what I try and work with organizations to do is think, how do you strengthen that communication? Because in today's communication world, where we are used to seeing very raw, very authentic content produced by people, by themselves, that's not heavily mediated, NGO content that seems quite mediated cannot feel very real. And in a place where we're suffering from trust deficit all over the place in terms of big organizations, that's a real risk. So I think that strengthening that communications line between donors and contributors can sort of do lots of positive things in terms of ethics, in terms of relationships, in terms of donor trust, and authenticity and storytelling. So that's kind of my answer. Yeah.
So here in the United States, I'm sure you have this. Sometimes when I'm talking to somebody in another part of the world, I have to qualify my questions because I don't know for sure that this plays out the same way.
Sure.
In the United Kingdom, but I'm certain it does. You guys are not. You're different, but you're not terribly different. you have the same issues with your political leaders and so forth.
Yes, we do.
Yes. So I grew up in the evangelical sort of parachurch world, and so a lot of my peers, and I never did this, but they go on these short term missionary trips, right? Mm-hmm. And you see this on Facebook, and we've seen it for years. So a young person, a teenager, a young adult, will go to a third world country, and they'll take a photograph of themselves that are surrounded by, oftentimes it's a Caucasian young person with a dark-skinned individuals. Yeah. And they're always smiling, and oftentimes they're in school uniforms and stuff. And so based on your research, do you think that those children, or sometimes they're young adults or peers or whatever, do you think that those children feel like those pictures accurately represent them? Or would they, you know, do they, what do you think their perception or understanding of what that photograph is? Because I've always, that's always made me pause. I thought some of these young people are going over and going to these countries. You've seen it. Mm-hmm. And they take these photographs, and I'm thinking, okay, so that's why you went on this trip, you know, is to take this photograph that sits beautifully on your Facebook stream. But so what's your thoughts on that? I know that's totally going down a bunny trail, but I always like to put my my guest on the spot on something slightly off track.
No, that's fine. Well, this is the white saviorism debate, isn't it? And this is,
yes,
you know, yes. Obviously, Comic Relief, you know, I had the UK charity Comic Relief had a huge kind of furore around this at the beginning of 2019 when a celebrity called Stacey Dooley tweeted a picture of herself hugging a young, you know, a black African baby and you know, and kind of tweeted it saying, I love this child. And, you know, the British political MP waded in and said, this is white saviorism and this is not useful. So one of the pieces of research that I review in the paper, the Ragari paper that I just published, is by an academic called David Gerling, who works at UEA in the UK. And he published this study called Which Image Do You Prefer? And one of the things that he looks at is what the people, across the East African area of the African continent think about the way that they are represented in communications. And it's very interesting. And he has quotes like, you know, made Africa look inferior and a continent in need. You know, why do they always have to have images of white people kissing black people? You know.
yes, exactly.
You know, there wasn't a lot of love in the room for that type of communication, as you know, obviously, from those people. And I think that, and actually there's a whole really, I don't know if you, but in Kenya, there's this Twitter is alive with this kind of debate all the time. There's lots of really, really interesting debates going on Twitter around this. And CNN in particular have really got it in the neck from the Kenyan Twitter community for these types of representations and communication. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan of this kind of thing. When I was content at Save the Children, I was able to say, because I was in a powerful position there, I was able to say, we will never publish a picture of this kind of, you know, we won't publish a picture like this, because ultimately it creates a colonial stereotype. I mean, that's the risk, is,
yes.
Is you're basically saying, I'm better than this person. They need me to help them. And it's still, you know, you see, I know it happens all the time. I follow various, you know, Facebook and Instagram feeds, not because I love them, but because I find them interesting, that where this kind of thing happens all the time. It's not that these people are not doing a good job. It's that some stereotypes perpetuate negative behaviors, which are not helpful in the long term. And so whether the images are true or not, it doesn't mean you should always show them. Truth is not an argument in that situation, I would say.
And so, okay, so this will be my last question. This is a fascinating conversation. I'm sure I could keep you going for another hour if you'd permit me, but I don't know that we'd hold on to our listeners. What do you think the donor's response to this is? So you talked a few moments ago about the sort of the donor's reaction to, I won't give to that particular picture. You know, do you think today's donor does want that more authentic, more real? Does the donor want us doing this, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
If we were or if we were not, is that part of the compelling message to know, for example, for me to know that Save the Children goes and has these conversations, however you have, you know, just as you've described you having these conversations, does that now inform my decision to now give because you have a better informed, I've honestly, admittedly never written a check to Save the Children, but I'm compelled to consider Save the Children now is because I know that you took the time and resources and mental energy, I guess you could say, to actually contemplate these difficult questions.
I suppose there are donors who are giving, it depends on the donor. I think the stories that come out of this different way of working, this way of working, which is more about looking for the contributor to be a partner as opposed to a subject, the stories that you get out are more compelling because they take a bit longer to get, and therefore you have a better relationship as the content gatherer with the person whose story you're gathering. They have more input, they're more real, they're more in depth, they're more authentic. And so that doesn't mean they can't be used for, you know, a door drop or a DRTV ad or a, you know, or a 1 minute film. But they're richer stories ultimately. In terms of whether the donor needs to know that that you're working in a different way with the donor, with the contributor, I think some donors really love that. So we had a donor at Save the Children who was already a major donor. But he found out about this new way we were working and was just so into it that it made him give a lot more money, and he wanted to get personally involved in the research. And, you know, he just, because he was really inspired by it. Whereas for other, you know, smaller gift donors, I guess for some people it's something they're really engaged in. For other people, they're engaged in the issues and they want to support that charity because they love that issue, not necessarily how, they don't really care how they gather stories. But ultimately, what you end up with for everyone is a better story, well told. And, you know, and I would say this because I work in content, but I do think stories are the currency of the NGO sector. If you, you know, without them, we don't have anything, whether you're sitting down across, you know, like you sitting across the table from a donor, or whether you're trying to get someone to stop doing their ironing and watch an ad on the TV, a powerful story is the best way to do that. And so anything that helps us do that better is, and do it in the right way, it's got to be a win-win.
Yes, thank you. Jess, if someone was listening today and they're interested, first of all, to my listeners, we will make sure to put a copy of a link to Ruggieri's report that Jess, I read it, like I said, I read it a month ago and read through it again yesterday. It's a wonderful, well-written report. Jess, thank you for doing that. But if somebody wants to reach out to you and says, and perhaps wants to continue the conversation or has a question based on what they've heard today, how would you suggest that they do that?
Yeah, if they come on my website, so it's jesscrombie.com. So nice and easy, jesscrombie.com. If you go on that, you can reach me through the website.
Okay, Jess, I will make sure to put a link to that on the, and are you findable on, I think you and I are connected on Facebook, but are you findable on, are you findable on LinkedIn?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, on all of them. So yeah, and I can do all these kind of conversations. So, you know, don't hesitate to get in touch.
Okay, good. All right. Yeah, I always try to get a sense of how social media friendly people are. I'm starting to figure all that out. Thank you, Jess. It has certainly been a pleasure.
No worries. Thank you so much.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.